This is the current federal tax developments for the week of May 1st, 2017. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and the Lascalzo Institute, a Kaplan company. This week, we're going to take a look at the problem with bright lines. We love having regulations that tell us exactly how things are supposed to work. We actually kind of like think that's a good idea. And we, you know, we just want to know what the rules are, we say at times. But the problem we sometimes run into with bright lines, and we'll see that in two cases here today, is that the bright lines in many cases result in somewhat unfair results. See, here's our problem. We can have fairness, we can have simplicity. Usually we'd like to try to figure out how to have both. Usually that's a problem. So we ran into this week. The cases this week we'll look at, we're going to take a look at a problem a taxpayer ran into trying to estimate wages for the research credit, at least in the view of the IRS attorney that authored a field advice. We're going to look at, secondly, an issue of the IRS publishing the new terminal charges and CIFL rates for this year, for this first half of this year. So if you have to do that, that's important. We have a memorandum that deals with a practical problem run into if you're trying to administer a qualified plan, or if you have a taxpayer who's participating in a qualified plan. We're going to look at how we compute the maximum amount of loans that can be outstanding or could be made to a participant in the plan. And the IRS tells us that actually there's a bit of confusion here. A memorandum discusses that it's not clear how to interpret the clause in certain cases. And they're going to tell you about two different ways they find acceptable. And finally, we have a veteran ends up on the wrong side of an election who wanted to have a foreign earned income exclusion. Problem is, those rules are very difficult to follow if you file a late return and discover they're messy rules. And this veteran ended up on the wrong side of the messy rules. Well, again, we're getting ready to go back out and start doing continuing education courses again. Want to remind those of you in Oregon, I have two courses coming up in May in Oregon. On May 18th, I will be doing real estate partnerships, get in, get out, get taxed. That'll be in the Beaverton offices of the Oregon Society of CPAs. That's in the Portland, Oregon area for those of you who aren't used to the area who might want to travel up. May 19th, in the same location, I'll be doing a day of assisting the survivors of a decedent's estate. That particular course will also look at the Oregon Uniform Principal and Income Act and how that applies and causes us issues with trusts and estates. Again, if you want to sign up for those courses, you can go online at orcpa.org. There you'll find all the information to sign up for Oregon Society CPA courses this year, including those courses here in May. Well, we're going to start taking a look at some of the key issues that happened this week. And let's start with some of our developments here. We're going to start with the fun area of the research credit. And the research credit's interesting because, you know, when you take a look at it, it offers some real opportunities for taxpayers to do some tax planning. There are many refund opportunities. In fact, there is a whole, you know, basic industry that's out there that many of us are aware of that's been developed with CPAs and others who go in and try to find unclaimed research credit for clients and for taxpayers. The problem we run into, though, is in the real world, sometimes clients don't keep and people don't want to keep data. Now, this can be because they weren't aware the data was needed. It can be because, you know, you may know it's needed and the IRS wants it. But the problem is that the people who would have to compile that data, who may not be accountants, may not feel like it's worth the bother. You've run into that many times, at least I have, when you try to talk to people about setting up, reimbursing employees or salespeople for auto expenses, and the salespeople balk at keeping a record of mileage. We end up with long discussions on that. Well, that's one of our problems here today. So the issue becomes, you know, how do you deal with that missing information? Well, the problem we're going to find in the case we're going to discuss here in just a second is lots of times we like to go back and say, well, let's just do an estimate. We know we must have at least this much. And if you think about the old Cohen case, normally in the tax law, if we have a reasonable basis of doing so, we can qualify for an estimate. But in this case, basically an IRS field attorney advice, is going to conclude that this isn't going to work, that the regulations require a specific method to be used. And if you don't have the records to do that method, you're just going to kind of have problems. The specific one we're looking at here is Field Attorney Advice 2017-1601F. It was issued by the IRS on April, I should say published on April 21st. These things are always redacted. So what ends up happening is they are finally published so we can read them, normally a few months after they really were released to the service. But this takes a look at Regulation 1.412D1. The problem here deals with if you have wages that are paid, that some of the wages for the employee relates to research operations, some of the wages paid to the employee will not result in that. This regulation tells us if that's the case, then the regulation outlines for us a specific method that we are supposed to be using to determine how much of those wages qualify for the research credit. And generally, it provides that in this case, we have the amount of wages allocated to performance of qualified service works. And basically, unless you can show a more appropriate method, the amount of in-house research expense shall be determined, the regulation tells us, by multiplying the total amount of wages paid to or incurred for the employee during the taxable year by the ratio of the total time actually spent in the performance of qualified services, that is research, over the total time spent by the employee for all services. So in order to make this work, what we have to have is we need a record, obviously, of all hours the employees work. Well, a lot of people have that. Although, let's be honest, sometimes if it was a salaried employee who's not subject to overtime rules, we might be missing those records. But the other catch is we have to know exactly what the employee was doing, or at least be able to document how much time we can show for sure the employee was actually doing research activities. In the case in question, the exam that led to this field attorney advice, they didn't have those records. They had no such records. So what ended up happening was that the controller ended up doing an estimate. And what they did, he identified employee he believed performed qualified service anytime during the year. Then the controller estimated the fraction of each employee's time that he spent performing qualified services. Multiplied came up with total wages. Now you might think that we stopped there. But they interestingly enough went on and did one more thing. We continued on and we did a second calculation, a second reduction in this. And the IRS, the field attorney advice made it clear, it wasn't clear why we did this, but they said, you know, it seems likely it's because they weren't sure that the controller's estimates were, you know, weren't off. So what he did was he did a denominator, was the number of projects that the taxpayer believed involved more than 50 hours of work by employees and might have involved at least one employee who conducted research. And the numerator is the number of projects in a denominator, basically, over a random sample of how many projects really had research. So we ended up first, let's think about where this goes. We have a general estimate of how much the controller believes represented research time. And then we went ahead and reduced that even further by coming up with a ratio of, okay, how many projects really had research when we did a detailed study of them? And we multiplied the controller's estimate, which in theory was what he thought was eligible, and then we reduced it yet again. Now the question becomes, can the taxpayer include this now double reduced amount of wages in computing the research credit? You might think, well, this sounds really conservative. And, you know, basically, it seems like it's probably less than what would really be there if we had records. Well, probably or not. Remember, the regulation required that special word. It must be more appropriate. The IRS actually, and you can read it if you go get our materials that are on the website for this week's write-up, comes up with what I think is a bit of a contrived example of a situation where this methodology would end up overstating the taxpayer's qualified research expense. I think it's very contrived. I think it's highly unlikely. But ultimately, they simply rule that because the taxpayer, there's no way you could show this is a more appropriate method than using the real numbers. And so because of that, they say essentially they need to go back and use real numbers. Now, of course, we realize the odds are they can't use real numbers. So most likely, no wage expense is going to count toward this particular taxpayer's research credit. And that probably means we're going to end up with substantially less or maybe no research credit after we end up taking that out of the equation. It also may mean, you know, the service may say, since we're supposed to be increasing our research, you know, the service will say you can't demonstrate increasing research when you can't figure out what the wages were. So we could have a problem all around with this. Is that reading the rule very, very narrowly? Yeah. But is that incorrect per the reg? Unfortunately, probably not. That's kind of an issue for this case. Even though the estimate may have been conservative, it didn't really matter. Well, let's go on to our next case in this case, in this issue. We're going to take a look in this case. Let's talk about compensation in general. Generally, anything received as compensation by an employee, even if it's non-cash, is taxable as wages to the employee. So if an employee receives something, you know, a benefit, it doesn't matter. You've got to pick that up as income unless there's an exemption under the code. This week, we're going to talk about an issue that's going to deal with what happens when an employee is riding along, maybe gets a personal rides along on the personal plane of the company. You know, the plane, let's say, is going to go from Phoenix to Dallas, and this employee just wants to tag along, got family in Dallas whatsoever. If the employee tags along, the value of that flight is compensation to the employee. Basic rule, no question. You can't argue that, well, it was going to Dallas anyway, who cares? You know, yes, if you're Southwest Airlines, you can argue that if there's an empty seat, but that's a special fringe benefit rule that's not open in this case because we're talking about planes where the flights are not being sold to the general public. So because of that, though, the IRS has provided via regulations standard rates that we can use to value such flights. We don't have to actually figure out the value of that plane, you know, figure out the total cost of the flight, how much did it cost to actually fly the plane, and then charge some proportion of that to the employee. We can rather use standard rates. And the IRS has published these standard rates now. They're published every 6 months. And we now have the rates out for valuing these things for the first half of 2017. Useful because, of course, we're coming up on the first payroll reports that are going to be due for 2017. This is Revenue Ruling 2017-10, issued on April the 24th. We're right at. Makes it a little interesting. The rates are used for the first 6 months of this year. Now, the terminal charge, which is one part of this calculation, is $38.85 for this time. The mileage rates range from 21.25 cents per mile up to basically just over 15.5 cents per mile. The rates are determined by mileage. So basically the way it works, there are three mileage levels and the mileage cost per mile goes down as the flight gets longer. Once you get to a flight over 1500 miles, we're at that 15.58 cent rate. If you have a flight of less than 500 miles, you have a rate of 21.25 cents. If you are at a flight that is between 500 and 1500 miles, then we're at 16.262 cents per mile. And that's the mileage. Those are the costs we're using for the first 6 months. Please remember on July 1st, these rates would change again. Next up, we're going to take a look at basically an issue of dealing with another fringe benefit issue. This time we're going to talk about loans to participants in qualified retirement plans. The tax law is very strict on this one. As I said, fringe benefits are taxable unless there's some exception. And one of the exceptions is amounts that go into a qualified plan for an employee from the employer are exempt. However, if the employee is allowed to borrow those funds out, that loan is considered to be a distribution unless, I know a few of you panicked at that, there is an unless coming, you meet strict rules. Now, remember, the catch is if you violate the rules, that loan just became a taxable disposition to the employee. Needless to say, employees aren't thrilled with having that. They don't want to have, you know, taxable compensation. Then still technically, per the terms of the loan, they still have to pay it back. So not going to be thrilled with that. And employers generally don't want to have that either, because you're going to do a fringe benefit. You probably want to make sure the employees are happy with your benefit, not upset with it. One of the key rules that's involved, you're going to find, is we have a $50,000 maximum loan amount. And a number of years ago, Congress put in a special rule that made this $50,000 maximum loan amount require a look back. By that, I mean, you have to look back. If you're going to give somebody a loan today, you have to reduce that $50,000 maximum. I will, now, by the way, for those of you who understand this, there's also a second limitation based on one half of your vested benefits. You can't go above that either. But the $50,000 rule says you've got to look back over the last 12 months and find and reduce that $50,000 by the highest balance of loans outstanding during the past 12 months. So, for instance, simple case. This was meant to prevent me from borrowing $50,000 from my plan today and then having essentially a running $50,000 loan by paying off the loan today and then 24 hours later have the plan issue me a new $50,000 loan. If I'm going to have $50,000 loans, I've got to basically, you know, pay them off and let it sit for a year. So I can't cumulatively have more than $50,000. I've got to always look back. Whenever I'm issuing a new loan, I've got to look back 12 months and make sure I don't have, you know, in essence, reduce my maximum loan about by the maximum amount I had in that past year. Well, problem is it's not quite that simple if there have been multiple loans which have been paid off in the prior 12 months. How do we compute the maximum balance? And that's where the IRS comes in with this particular tax memorandum. This memorandum, which is from the Tax Exempt and Government Entities Division of the IRS, it is TEGE 04-0417-0016, issued on April the 20th. And this goes back and looks at the case. The example it's going to deal with here is, let's say a participant borrowed $30,000 in February, fully repaid in April. Then in May, he borrows another $20,000, fully repays it in July. Now in December, he comes in for a third loan. Question, is he eligible for a loan? And there are two ways you could compute that. You know, he took a $30,000 loan out. Now there's no question there, pays that back. When he goes for the loan in May, there's no question that essentially the max he can take is 20 grand. But now he's paid that loan off. Now let's see, he had a $30,000 loan at one point. Then we max him up to a $20,000 loan. Now again, both of those have been paid off. Now the question becomes, in December, does he have any borrowing capacity? And the IRS in this memorandum says, well, the law is not clear on that one. In essence, under one piece of logic, maybe he's already at his maximum. 30,000 plus 20,000 is 50. He maxed out. When he borrowed in basically in May and took the $20,000 loan then, well, that basically blocked him from making any more borrowings until we got past that first $30,000 loan. But the IRS said, but you could look at it another way. If he hadn't paid off the $30,000 loan, but instead that loan had stayed in place, and so he had paid $10,000 down on it, then he went and paid $20,000. Well, then his max would have been $30,000. So the question becomes, you know, do we take into account that he never had more than $30,000 outstanding at any point during the year? Or do we have to say that, no, it's $50,000. You have to add the two up. The memorandum concludes that either one of these methods is fine. If a plan has been using either definition, as long as you do it consistently, you can't discriminate against employees, but if you do this consistently, either one of those methods that you've been using to interpret your plan document is acceptable. And according to this memorandum, agents are not to challenge it so long as they've used one of those two methods. So if you have this situation, you can do either method. Just remember, you do have to be consistent. You can't give the owners the benefit of the, you know, the no, those are separate loans and the maximum amount was 30 grand. But then for the rank and file, say, oh, sorry, you've already taken your 50. You got to be consistent, But if you're consistent, then we should be in good shape, and this gives us some flexibility to deal with this situation. Next up is the foreign earned income exclusion. Now, anybody who's used that knows you have a client that's working in a country other than the U.S. Please remember that. It's not outside the U.S. They have to be in a country, not in the U.S. We had those Antarctica cases a few years ago, and we've had the flight attendant cases of flying over international waters. Neither Antarctica nor international waters are another country, so wages you earn for that don't qualify for the exclusion. But if you do qualify, it's useful for moderate earnings. Obviously, if you're being paid $500,000, it's not going to work for most of your earnings. But if you have earnings below 100 grand, you know, basically it's worked for many years and wipes those things out. It's great. And it's a full exclusion. So it's very simple. You don't pay tax. And we don't worry about then having to do things like the foreign tax credit to figure out how much of your, you know, how much of the wages that maybe were taxed by both the US and the Netherlands are now going to be subject to, you know, where do we get the credits, which country gets the credit, and exactly how much do we work with that? You know, that whole mess is gone. So we have that particular issue. But, you know, you might think, well, there we follow Form 2555. But it's important to note Form 2555 really is an election. You are electing. You do not have to use the foreign earned income exclusion. And because of that, it's an election, and the law provides that the IRS can tell us how that election is to be made. In the regulations that deal with this, there is a set of regulatory deadlines for making this election. If you make this election, you have to make it by a certain date. Now, the IRS did not go with just saying it's got to be made on a timely filed return. Rather, we're going to find out that this is a rather complicated set of rules, but the number one thing to take away from this is if a taxpayer files a return more than a year late, the taxpayer is at risk to losing the ability to make this election unless the taxpayer has no tax due at all once this election is made. If any tax, even a dollar of tax, would be due on a taxpayer's return if this election, even with the election being made, the taxpayer is at risk if the IRS discovers the problem first. Now we're going to take a look at the case where the question becomes, did the IRS discover the problem first? This week, we're looking at the case of Redfield versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2017-71. That case deals with this issue. Now, the way the rules work, let's talk about what we're going to do here. There are basically five different ways we test the exclusion to see if the election is timely. The easiest way to make a timely election is if you file a return, a timely return before the due date, including extensions, you include 2555. No problem, you're in. What if you didn't make the election on that return, but you did timely file? Then an amended return, as long as the statute's still open, is also fine. Okay, what if you don't file on time? Well, then we get to a third test. You absolutely can still make the election if you file late, as long as you file it within 1 year of the unextended due date. Okay, so there's three tests. Now the catch comes. What if it's been the taxpayer did not file on time and it's been more than a year? Can the taxpayer still make the election? Well, in that case, there are two tests. First, if the taxpayer files the Form 2555 with a return, and we do so before any contact from the IRS, we're still good. No problem. However, if the IRS has contacted the taxpayer, then if there is no tax due after the election's made, so the IRS contacted, the only income the taxpayer had was $60,000 of foreign wages, the taxpayer then puts the election in, that'll wipe out the $60,000 of income. There is no tax due on the return now with that on there. Good, election now is still timely made. But what if the taxpayer, in addition to having those $60,000 of foreign wages, let's say the taxpayer had $20,000 of US wages, and because of that filing single, et cetera, there's a small amount of tax due on those $20,000 even with the election. Now we have a problem. If the IRS has contacted the taxpayer, discovered the problem, is the way the regulations refer to it, now the election is not valid. The election has now been made late. If there's any tax going to be due after the election is made, you must file it before the IRS discovers the problem. In this case, we have a taxpayer who was a veteran, had been in Afghanistan. He had been there a number of tours of duty, very stressful, had physical and mental issues, but he decided he was still good enough and he was going to be okay, thought he recovered enough that he could take a civilian job in Afghanistan. So he was no longer in the military. He was now going to be working for a civilian group in Afghanistan. It turned out he really wasn't recovered enough to do this, and probably going back there didn't help matters in terms of stress. So he worked the job for a while, but he then left the job, came back over. Now, the catch was he ended up with $49,136 of earnings on that job in Afghanistan. The problem we're going to run into is he failed to file a 2010 return. And he failed to file for a number of years. In 2014, the IRS issues a substitute for return, SFR. Obviously, the IRS just taxes everything, including those wages from Afghanistan. The taxpayer now puts a corrected return in and says, wait, these are my real numbers, and here's my foreign earned income exclusion. The IRS says, well, thank you for the return. We're going to correct our SFR, but the IRS position was, we're not going to allow the foreign earned income exclusion. The IRS position was, you didn't file this election on a timely basis. And there is no special rule in the regulation that allows for, reasonable cause, any of those things. Rather, under this rule, you have to file it timely. Now, we talked about this case a couple of years ago, talked about the same issue, except without the veteran complex or the potential issues of reasonable cause in the case of McDonald versus Commissioner. And the McDonald case, similar sort of problem. And in that case, the court found that an SFR was an IRS discovery for this purpose. The IRS discovered, the courts effectively said it wouldn't make a whole lot of sense to say the IRS has to not only say, hey, here's these wages that you didn't report, but oh, by the way, they've got to figure out the wages were in Afghanistan and you met one of the two tests that would allow you to claim the foreign income exclusion. Court said, no, that doesn't make sense. If they've contacted you, then they have discovered that you didn't file a return. If you didn't file a return, they've discovered you didn't make an election if one was possible under this rule. So as such, tough luck, guys, you've got to pick that up. You cannot do that exclusion. The court said, look, we understand. In fact, we understand your service to the country. We recognize the stress and the problems that came. We understand that these procedural requirements are messy. They're complicated. It's not easy to understand why these things work the way they do. But the court found the law is, the regulation and the law gives no out. You have to do this. Now, this can help excuse your penalties. This could be useful for collection issues. But it's not going to help you in terms of getting out of being able to actually claim the exclusion on this return. That, unfortunately, there is no option. Well, remind you, we are now into the time where you probably started getting your CP catalogs from your state societies. And now's the time to sign up for courses if you haven't already. Note, almost all the state societies allow you to sign up online. So you go online, take a look at the courses. We, of course, here at La Scalzo Institute have courses in both accounting and tax we're doing for state societies around the country. So you want to go ahead and take a look at your state society catalogs. I'm going to be doing courses this year in a whole bunch of states. I'm going to be doing some courses here. As I've said, Arizona, obviously have a number here. Have a number of courses. I have some coming up in Washington. I'll be doing courses in Oklahoma. I'll be doing courses in New Jersey. So I've got various places around the country. Be doing some up in July in Montana, in Bozeman, if you're up in that area. So check your state society catalogs. Go ahead and sign up now. By the way, it really helps the state societies if you do sign up early. The catch is the earlier you sign up, and this is really important when you consider the cost of travel. Some of you may have been involved with cases where, a course just didn't get enough people signed up. one of the reasons what happens and why courses sometimes have to be canceled is because by the time we discover there are enough people to make it financially viable to do the course generally, do the general expenses that we have that are controllable, the airfare has gone to the ridiculous. So the earlier that you can sign up, the more you prevent that. I do remember one case where when you get within a week of the day of the course, the airfare went from about $400 to $1,600. Yeah, that makes a difference because you can take a look at the cost per person, of course, and you realize that that's probably going to require you to have four or five more people sign up just to pay for the airfare. So the earlier you can sign up, the better you'll do and help your societies get the courses you want for your state society. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of May 1st, 2017. You want to catch our daily updates, you know, when we do them during the week, and they're not always daily, but as I get time to write things up, I'll post updates at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also download a PDF with our articles from that site. You can send any questions and comments to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also follow me on Twitter. I'm at edzollers. Well, as we say, we're done for one more week here. So I look forward, have fun this week doing your tax work. We'll take a look. We'll keep our eye on what happens in taxes for the week and get back here next week. And we'll talk about the additional developments in things that have happened in the area of federal taxes.